In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Dr. Danny Lamartina, doctor of physiotherapy, IFBB Olympian, coach, consultant, and problem solver. Danny and I spoke about the relationship between biomechanics and physiology, the importance of nasal breathing, and how we're often just one pivot away from a solution. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Danny, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating, or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Danny. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Danny Lamartina. She's a doctor of physiotherapy and an IFBB Olympian, coach, consultant, and a problem solver. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
I'm really, really excited to speak with you. I love your content, especially on Instagram, and how you just make things seem so simple, or explain biomechanics and physiology in a very logical way. And I'm excited to dig into all of these things today.
Thanks. I hope I can provide some insight. I have the benefit of having very smart friends that help me kind of make things make sense.
So. Awesome. Well, and I mean, most people that go into the gym regularly, they have some sort of niggly spots or something that hurts from time to time. So I hope too that we will be able to provide some solutions for people. But before we do, I would love to hear a little bit about you and your background. Maybe you can tell us how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. So I'm a physical therapist. I graduated physical therapy school almost 10 years ago now, which is kind of wild to say. And I never thought I was going to be doing what I do right now. I work primarily with mostly men and some women who have a very long training history, lots of muscle mass, things like that. And obviously, there are some unique kind of problems that come with that, and they require a little bit of a unique solution. I started out in powerlifting and started kind of consulting there. And over time, I had some of my own medical issues that took me out of training and kind of found bodybuilding as I got into that, and then kind of stuck with that, ended up on the Olympia stage in very quick time. And I think what's been really fun for me about that has been kind of creatively solving problems that I didn't have a clinician to walk me through. So it was kind of like this convergence of, you know, my clinical knowledge and what I've been taught, and at the same time, looking at a situation that, like, we don't have research on, you know, highly, highly trained bodybuilders, highly, highly trained powerlifters, things like that. So figuring out how to kind of marry those things with my own experience was a kind of like practical lab work, I guess.
Awesome. Yeah, I think many of the listeners fall into like one of or the other category in the sense of training for strength or training for just aesthetics and hypertrophy or a bit of both as well. And to kick us off, I would love to hear kind of your explanation on, first of all, what is biomechanics? What do we mean when we talk about physiology and how the relationship of the two kind of come together in what you do?
Yeah. This is a really, gosh, I could talk about this one for a while. So if at any point I start like going down a rabbit trail and need to rein me back in, don't be shy too. But I think, you know, a lot of times people think about biomechanics and think planes of motions and they think joints and things like that. And they kind of forget some of the very basic principles that drive a lot of that, and in particular, fluid dynamics. And fluid dynamics, when we think about the human body, is how much of us is fluid? Probably most of it. So from the biomechanical standpoint, I use quite a bit of just that kind of principle of physics. But when we get into even the integration of some of the physiology, looking at things like CO2 tolerance and how someone's structure might change, how well they tolerate things like that, how someone's structure might change, how sensitive they are to changes in vagal tone, things like that, specifically through diaphragmatic position and function. And how does that change throughout periodization and something like bodybuilding prep versus an off season? I mean, there's so many different directions to go. And I think ultimately one of my favorite things to look at is just to kind of take that, the ability to zoom out and see with a little bit of altitude rather than looking at specifically like a bodybuilding prep or an off season, but looking at the organism as a whole of what do those different phases represent with regards to current status, what we're looking to change, you know, kind of all of that.
And I could imagine that someone's genetics or just personal anatomy plays a huge role in that as well, like in the sense of certain lever length, or in the sense of even just like optimal positioning for squatting, or where they're more naturally inclined to hypertrophy versus in other people.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm not going to take credit for any of this. I think Bill Hartman has done the industry so much good, and he can be a little bit challenging to understand because his principles are very nuanced. But even when we're thinking about someone's structure and how that's going to dictate where they grow better, where they don't, what movements they're really good at, and what movements they're not great at, a lot of that comes back to the idea of fluid management, pressure management, and kind of the shape of our rib cage and pelvis. And so that's a little bit of a rabbit hole. But anytime I talk to someone who has pain or has some sort of a problem with training, I think one of the first things that we can do is step back and look at, well, are you doing things because you think you need to be doing it a certain way based on what someone tells you? Or are you doing things based on what you know has worked for you? And then kind of being able to step back and think about, okay, well, if we know X, Y, and Z works for you, what are the components of those movements? Why do they work well? And how can we translate that to other things? Does that make sense?
To me, it makes 100% sense, and I have a few personal thoughts coming into mind for that. So, for example, when I got into strength training, it was more through CrossFit, as opposed to anything else. And I was always told knees out, knees out, knees out when squatting, and that resulted into me not really utilizing my hip flexors properly, and kind of like pushing the knees out too much. Whereas like my actual natural anatomy is much more squatting with the knees forward, and like, and I now know that I do much better with that, and it's kind of created some issues with my sciatic nerve for a while as well, when I
Oh,
was just
wow.
trying to force myself to squat in the way which is not so natural to me. And I know that that cue was super well intended. Like, obviously most people have their knees caving in. But if if you kind of go against your natural stance, or I think then, as someone always hearing like, oh, you need to go ass to the grass no matter what on your squat, or like just those blanket statements, regardless of someone's natural anatomy, I think that that's kind of a little bit of an issue. Of course, if we're talking about certain competitions, we need to make sure we're reaching a certain depth and
Right.
on naturally in powerlifting, et cetera. I understand that. But nonetheless, I think powerlifters, successful ones anyway, are very, very good at adapting their stance, how they hold a bar, and whatever to whatever works best for them, like a high bar, a low bar. Are you doing sumo? Are you doing regular? And all these kind of things. And I'm curious if you have a more or less novice or even intermediate lifter coming to you, or I guess starting with the ambition of wanting to get a bit more competitive, how would you even go about like saying, for you, we want to assess whether you're doing a sumo is better than a regular deadlift or conventional deadlift, or yeah, I guess how can we find out what the best positioning is for us?
Well, I think there are a couple different layers and different ways to answer that. I mean, first, you're hitting on a really, really cool concept with regards to our bony morphology. Like, just based on hip sockets, we're going to be better at squatting in certain positions than others. But there's another layer to that, and that is the fact that as we go through a particular motion, our body, our pelvis, our rib cage needs to be able to change shape a little bit. And as we go through those motions, there are going to be different rotational demands as our body kind of does change shape. And so if we layer on a couple of different aspects to that, we already know, okay, someone might be really good at squatting narrow. Maybe that's a good position for them. When we put a bar on their back into a low bar position, how does that change the shape of their rib cage, and how does that subsequently affect their pelvis? Because now we have some muscular adaptations. And if we compound that over time, that's going to change things like connective tissue. So my first bias with regards to people who want to start to take their training more seriously is I think that as coaches, especially, we need to do a much better job of having an assessment protocol. And I think that's something that especially I work exclusively in the online space. And coming from a clinic where I was in person, for some reason, there's a little bit of a change in expectation. People think they're going to go see someone in person, they expect to get an assessment, right? But when they start with an online coach, for some reason, they think they're just going to get a program. And it's kind of like, well, why are we not assessing where we're starting from so that we have a good idea not only of, okay, if this is what your bony structure says, here's we know what we should expect. If you cannot do that, How has your body changed shape to accommodate for that? What other kind of downstream effects are there on your connective tissue? And then even on top of that, we know that with regards to genetics, it's not just our bone shape. There's so much about our thought patterns and our thought processes, and we write that off as like, okay, I'll touch on that later, but there's a direct correlation between those things and how our body moves. I did a seminar at one point where I took someone who's generally a high tone, very positive person, did some muscle testing, range of motion, everything looked great. He was someone I knew pretty well, so I felt bad doing this, but I said some really mean things to him and changed range of motion thoughts, or I'm sorry, changed range of motion and muscle kind of reactivity very quickly. And so when it comes to genetic predisposition, I think we're very apt to think only about our bony morphology, maybe muscular attachments, things like that, how our body is put together. But we also need to recognize that there are going to be other elements that are going to come into play that change you. To change the expression of what our body kind of externally does, if that makes sense.
Wow. Yeah. No.
That was a lot.
It was a lot, and I do think that that's quite eye-opening. I mean, if we look at ourselves, even because beyond genetics, beyond anatomy, and so on, you mentioned thoughts and beliefs, and so layer injuries in there, layer things they have heard from, or we have heard from various coaches. If you've gone, like, bring that back to elementary, or your very
Yeah.
first coach in whatever sport it might have been, someone saying one comment to you, and that sticks with you for the rest of your life, like, oh, you always need to be explosive, or you're always the slowest person, or like just some random comment that stuck
Great.
with you for whatever reason. Yeah, and I think then on to that, maybe some other things that we've picked up from the internet, where we saw a reel and someone is saying something, oh, you should never squat below parallel, or like I don't know,
Yeah.
the most random things that everyone has heard. And so then when you arrive at a new coach, with you or with me or whoever, every person arrives with their perhaps limiting beliefs or with their preconceived notions, and that is definitely hard to break at times.
I think there's so much power in coaching with that too. We're in a really, really unique position right now with the coaching industry, and that there's an enormous trust recession going on because we've been told, don't do this, don't do that. There's been all the negative hook marketing for so long, and that will change our brain state. So not only are we, getting the change in our neurochemistry from scrolling social media, we're also seeing all the negative things, right? We're getting kind of that like double whammy. And I think what's been really, really cool, and the things that I've kind of looked at more with my own clients lately, has been, yeah, I run them through testing and things like that. And yeah, I want to look at the range of motion. I want to know their connective tissue behavior. I want to know, their injury history, all the things that you think that we'd want to think about. But I have a couple of people where I've looked much less at that and much more at their self-dialogue and what I'm doing to facilitate that self-dialogue. And that doesn't mean being rah-rah, right? A lot of times that means putting them into a state of independence and in the thought pattern, not relying on me. And how that is one of the biggest kind of catapulting forward, movements that I've seen from people. And you've probably seen this with your clients and people that you work with as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when people have had injuries, I find that really, really tricky. Or, I mean, if we're talking about weight loss, that's a whole other story. But let's stick with the sort of the physiological aspect. If someone's had an injury, and as you would know, then you just kind of like ingrain those thought patterns, and you perhaps develop some movements to avoid that pattern or that pain in the first instance. But maybe the injury has healed 10 years ago, and you're still doing that evasive movement because it's so deeply within your body of like, hey, don't move that way because I could hurt. And yeah, breaking that, I would imagine, is very, very difficult. And yeah, especially online, I would say it's sometimes even more difficult.
For sure. It's challenging, and at the same time, I think that maybe I just get really lucky, but when I start with someone, I generally feel like they do a really good job of trusting me. And I think that has to do with, again, like my heart in all of this, Lisa, is I want to move the coaching industry forward and just be this tiny little ripple wherever I can, right? I think we've probably both seen people that we care about work with coaches who are maybe not great coaches, and we're like, man, like you deserve so much better. I think one of the best things that we can do as coaches is remember that our first step is to engender trust. And that comes from how we walk in our own lives. That comes from how we show up for them. That comes from how we show up for ourselves as well. You know, if we want someone to be able to engender self-trust, well, we need to be able to make sure that we're doing that as well.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think part of that is also sometimes saying, I don't know, or saying when we're wrong, or saying when, okay, actually, we're just going to try something. I don't really know for sure. But if you're okay with it, can we, give this a go and then see how you're feeling after 2 weeks or so? But one thing I wanted to go back to, which you mentioned earlier, or actually mentioned it a couple of times, and that was diaphragm and rib cage and breathing in general. And I am and was surprised when I looked at your content the first time. I was like, how is this even like really relevant? I mean, we often hear the only time that we often think about or hear about breathing when it comes to lifting or anything like that is like, okay, should I breathe in or out when I'm in the concentric or the eccentric phase, or should I hold my breath or so? So those are like, for the most people, the only times that I'm really asked about, like, oh, I don't know when I should breathe in or out, but it's not necessarily like at the forefront of our mind. So I would love to hear why you're so passionate about the diaphragm and breathing and just in general, VO2 max and so on.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different directions I could take with this. From a purely performance and like biomechanical standpoint, obviously that is super, super important. So the world that I live in with my guys is generally they want to perform and they want to do things that if we were going to look at it, like the things that they do are probably not great for joints, not great for the nervous system. Like it's not great for them, right? So my job becomes knowing they want to do this thing. How can I get them to do that, but also offload some of that and kind of recalibrate the system to dampen whatever negative effects there are? I have a different kind of framework that I could talk about just as a visual, but so we have the performance side, but then we also have kind of what I was talking about, the interaction of physiology. And just at its core diaphragm. It's so funny.
I like what you did there.
So like we know that the vagus nerve descends through the diaphragm, right? And we also know the vagus nerve, I think people hear about it and because we're so used to hearing about it, it becomes pretty diluted. But it is an enormous part of controlling our autonomic nervous system, which is going to not only affect a lot of how we feel, but it affects how we move. It affects how we think. I mean, you want to talk about someone who's having a great day, they probably got a regulated autonomic system. Someone who's maybe not so much. There's that level of kind of dysregulation. A lot of that, not all, but a lot can come from kind of massaging vagal tone a little bit. So from an autonomic standpoint, we know the right and left vagus nerve are going to descend through the diaphragm. And I want to come back to the kind of biomechanical model. If we talk about a rib cage, that rib cage is going to tell us how that diaphragm is shaped a little bit. And that sounds a little bit esoteric, but if you actually go through, gosh, Zach Couples, I think, posted an article at one point looking at how different lineages can have a different shape of the rib cage. And the reason that's important is the diaphragm obviously is going to work within that. On top of that, we also have some asymmetry within that muscle. The right side tends to be in a little bit more of an inhaled state. Sorry, exhaled state, with the liver right below it. The heart is a little bit above it on the left side, just slightly to the left of center. So already we have this inherent asymmetry in a muscle that controls a large portion of our autonomics. So, I mean, I think just from that standpoint, we can kind of appreciate that that's important. It seems a little bit esoteric, but now if we want to start talking about, okay, well, let's come back to that person who has maybe built a little bit like yourself, who's got a little bit more of a narrow structure, narrow rib cage, and now we're going to put a low bar on the back of her. And that's going to change the shape of that system. That diaphragm is going to have to change shape with that as the rib cage moves. It's a very dynamic structure. So now we're going to start to see some potential change in vagal tone over time if we don't shift out of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting. I literally never thought of it in that way, or even though it's so logical, but even that the rib cage shapes what our diaphragm looks like. So that is so interesting. And how you're saying like the how narrow it is or not, that's one aspect of it. I would assume that also just how it what it looks like in terms of 360, is it more like
Oh,
round, or
completely.
is it more like oval, or like anything?
Man, it's been really fun for me. I've kind of gone on this nerd spree, I would say, probably more in the last couple of weeks, just because I think, again, as coaches, I'm always like, or as a coach, I'm like, okay, I need to stay sharp. Like, what can I do to make sure that I'm not just like falling into my rut? So I've started pulling up like pictures of my current clients, and they're people who participate basically in the same sport or close, which is very heavy lifting. And looking at how we can kind of appreciate where someone starts, what happens as we start to add on layers of mass and layers of muscle? How does that change the shape? And recognizing how dynamic the ribcage structure is, and it's a function of a little bit of spine position and spine bias. It's been really cool to just take side by sides of my clients and like kind of put them next to each other and kind of create the spectrum and appreciate not only what's happening from like front to back, but if we were going to view them from a top down, what's happening in the superior portion of the rib cage, because there's a lot of stuff that happens here from the physiological side as well. I want to think again about autonomics from vagus lymph support. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff that runs through this area. So that's always really interesting. Yeah, I think just thinking about the three-dimensional structure can be really, really interesting. And we think about the rib cage and people kind of like, I was on a podcast routinely for a while, and I think people got like, we're just gonna talk about the rib cage. But it's hugely important because anytime we hold weight, we have to recognize that the mechanism by which we stabilize ourselves depends on the rib cage's ability to sustain that pressure and change shape as needed. But for whatever reason, we kind of lose touch with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just like trying to, because I always like to give people like practical takeaways, and obviously if someone is not working with a coach or so, but what does that really mean for us practically in the sense of, well, assessing ourselves perhaps, but also just in the sense of if we want to lift with maximum safety, but perhaps maximum weight, or just safety long term over the course of the years, what do we need to pay attention to with when it comes to breath or literally anything?
I would actually shift that away from the actual training itself and think about what you're doing the rest of the day. And the reason for that is we need to handle load safely, right? And that's kind of like a high skill thing. That's where you can work with a coach. But in general, at first I was thinking, along the concepts of where do people need to be able to move better on the rib cage. And I'm going to make that even more simple for you. And I think that even sitting here, if I turn sideways, I hope you can see this. The ability to nasal breathe is an enormous component of being able to actually restore rib cage mobility. I mean, like we have our ribs attached to our spine at multiple levels, right? And each one of those is a joint that needs to be able to have some small degree of joint excursion to help manage pressure, change the volume of the thoracic cavity, all those things. The ability to nasal breathe is one of the things that will promote on the back of my upper rib cage here. Are you able to see how much that kind of expanded?
Yeah, so for the listeners or the people that are only listening and not seeing the video, it was definitely a very, very visible change in the sense of it looked like a balloon, basically. If I pictured a balloon in that area, it would have absolutely expanded.
That's an awesome way to think about it. And so, kind of the other caveat to that is we know nasal breathing is important. And then again, we know that that's going to change some of the biochemical thing, the components of what goes on through the nasal passages. But how we go about doing that is also important. And if there's one kind of very simple takeaway that I would give people listening, it's the ability to nasal breathe quietly. We're not hearing like, any of the tension that might indicate that there's muscular activity going on in the neck or anywhere in the facial, kind of oral facial cavity. So silent nasal breathing, if you're especially sitting at a desk during the day, every now and then stop, kind of stack your rib cage over your pelvis, rest your arms wherever they're gonna go, silent nasal breathing. And if you can kind of sense a little bit of your whole rib cage just almost like ballooning up, you might even feel it down in your pelvis too. And there's some really cool stuff that happens when you can start to sense that. As silly as it sounds, the ability to do that throughout the day, like, man, I know if I can't feel that in the day and I go to train, like my training just doesn't feel great. And it is what it is, right? Like we can't always have perfect sessions. But if I have that KPI to help manage pressure, change the relative position of the shoulder blade on the rib cage, which is gonna let my shoulders feel better, there's a lot of other stuff that happens and you can find that one like kind of powerful linchpin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I mean, expanding on that, I could imagine that it's also so quite important to you how we breathe during the night then, because from what I hear, like mouth breathing at night and or sleep apnea and so on, such big issues when it comes to the oxygen in our blood or just generally like health-wise. There are so many facets to that, but I would imagine that expands into the night as well.
Absolutely. Especially for some of the larger guys that I work with, again, they've got a lot of mass. And so pretty much all of them use some sort of a CPAP, which is great. It's really good for them. I'm glad we have that tool. But when they start being able to nasal breathe more during the day, it's cool because when we think about even things like arterial blood gases, being able to have a biochemical gradient that promotes not only better fluid flow, but as fluid flows, we're going to get different ion channel changes. A lot of times people get a better pump in their training. So, like, I don't want to oversimplify and be like, breathe better, you're going to get a better pump. There's a biomechanical basis for that. But I think that, again, just like incentivizing doing the easy things well, we have all the tricks in the world right now in the coaching industry. We have a lot of science, but what's the easiest way that we can prove some of these things? What's the simplest way we can do it?
Yeah,
So that's
really.
what I try to kind of get to with people.
I love that because it's also a free tool. It doesn't cost anything. We do, and it makes up for such a large percentage of what we do during the day. But yeah, sometimes unfortunately we want the sexy fancy hack rather than being told,
Like,
oh,
let me use my
you're
really
breathing.
cool. I talked to someone yesterday who they have, it's a couple and they have a mattress, and each side of the mattress measures their independent, like, respiration rate, HRV, like really, really fancy, right? And I was going through some testing with them. I was kind of like, look, you and I are literally seeing right now exactly what your mattress is telling you. So why are you seeing me? Like, you have your tools, but people need the accountability, I think, most often. So yeah, really easy, simple things I think are important.
Very, very much so. And one thing that I like about kind of your mission is also that you say that many people, or you want to show people that they're probably just one pivot away from shifting their trajectory completely. And I love that because sometimes people feel like, oh, I've tried everything, or they feel like, oh, maybe there's no solution for me out there, or why are the things that I used to be doing not working for me and they were working so well? And so how do you guide someone towards that pivot?
I love that you brought that up. That's like my whole heart is like literally you for the coaching industry, number one, we can do better. But for my clients, like, you are one conversation away from a solution that can change so much for you. Everything that you just mentioned with like, oh, okay, I've tried everything, or I have this big injury. What's it all rooted in? It's all rooted in fear. And I think we have to speak directly to that fear, if I'm being honest. And I think people are afraid to hope for more for themselves for a couple reasons. I think if they hope for more than for themselves and they can't accomplish the goal, they're afraid of the emotional letdown. I think our brains are very, very smart and anticipate that when we cannot do something, it knows it's going to change our internal belief state about ourselves. And so it tries to avoid that. I think the other fear, is you just saw my brain stop.
No,
So people are afraid to want better for themselves, but I think people are afraid that they really are kind of stuck that way. And so if they reach out and something doesn't work, it just kind of confirms that they're worse off than they thought. And they're like, well, I'd rather be, sitting here missing a limb than try to make it better and miss two. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I definitely agree with that most people, yeah, I guess we can say fear, or I often say like lacking self-worth, when you don't feel like you're worthy
Oh.
of being pain-free, of lifting even more, of having the physique that you want,
Oh,
of
man.
achieving your dream or so, then you are going to sabotage, or you're gonna think you're only gonna put, I don't know, 60% of the effort in when you actually have more, or you're not allowing yourself to ask for that. Like, what is that ultimate pivot point that I really, really want? So is that mostly through conversation that you then show your clients or show people that you're speaking with, like, hey, this is the way that we need to go down, and that's the pivot? Or how do you find that pivot point?
I think it really depends on the individual. I want to touch on this briefly. I don't want to talk about myself too much, but everything you just mentioned with regards to self-worth is huge. And so I came off of arguably probably about the fastest I could have gotten to the Olympia stage. I did my first bodybuilding show. I won it so I could qualify for nationals. I won my first national show. My first pro season, I placed top 10 in my debut, which was good. And then the next year I went to the Olympia. Like that's very, very quickly. On top of that, I was at one point one of the top 10 strongest in the world. I have, a doctoral degree from Duke University. Like from the outside, it looks like I should have all the self-worth. And I think for myself and for a lot of other people, the higher we climb, the more fragile that self-worth becomes. And we're waiting almost to actually feel like, okay, cool, I did this cool thing. Did I just get lucky? Is this not actually me? And the minute that actually happens, so like for me, I came off the Olympia stage and or I won my first pro show, which is a huge deal. And my husband is a really he's an amazing man. He's very low key. He's not outwardly expressive. So I went through this huge ordeal. I won a pro show. It was something I never thought I was going to do. Got off stage, and even though I knew he was low expression, his low expression made me feel like it wasn't good enough. I had to go to the Olympia and do okay at that to earn his respect. Was not the case. But eventually, the more and more we reach for that feeling of self-worth without knowing it's there, man, I had a really, really hard rock bottom last year. Training has been my life. And leading into the Olympia, I was having small seizures like twice a week. Leading into Chicago Pro, I was having one almost weekly when I was training legs. After the Olympia, I got some follow-up blood work and they found that I had, I'm going to air quotes this, lupus. I don't know how much I truly believe that, but I spent basically all of 2024 not training at all. So the complete 180 of my entire life had revolved around training. My business depended on me being a dancing bear on the internet and doing deadlifts for, 405 or 12. It depended on me showing up and being really, really smart. Depended on me basically proving my worth all the time. 2024 was really hard because all of the stuff, my whole house of cards kind of just got like flipped over. I had to stop training for quite a while. I went through some other things to try and start feeling better from the functional medicine standpoint. And I cannot sing the praises enough of the people who have been in my corner. Particularly Austin Stout was my coach to help deal with some of the inflammatory issues, and he's been incredible. And then Chris Edmonds is a bodybuilding coach who has just been in my corner day one always. And has seen me in the dark places and met me there, but also helped me move forward, power and presence. So when we talk about self-worth, and when I come to meet my clients, a lot of the guys that I work with are men who I feel like they're told they have to make more money. They're told they're not allowed to have needs. They're told they're only as good as the weight they lift. They're high functioning CEOs or, professionals that have to show up and be 100% every day. If they're 98%, it's not enough. And so I really, man, like I really freaking feel for these guys, man. They don't have many places, even in their families. Like they have great support, but I think anytime you're expected to be a leader in multiple circumstances, it can feel a little bit crushing at times. It's very empowering if you have the right people in place. So, with each of my guys, they have a little bit of a different situation, right? And I think it's not my, like, I'm not going to be their therapist. I'm not going to talk to them about, a lot of the self-worth things, but or not like super far down that rabbit hole. But I can engender things that allow them to trust themselves, to show up for themselves, and for shift the sense of leadership and self-worth from something that's externally driven to internally driven. And a lot of these guys, they intercept them at a point, and I think you probably have people who are injured too. Motivation is low, right? And so if we think about, just even the science of motivation, there are certain pillars that contribute to that. And on a very broad scale, there's, autonomy, mastery, and I forget what the third one is, but there are some other kind of more nuanced components to this. And one of the words is autotelicity. And that term talks about something where you love the thing for the thing itself. not necessarily for the outcome. And I think for a lot of us who have started to train, and at first we really loved it, right? I think most of us who have been at it for a long time, we at least go through a phase where training kind of feels like a burden. Motivation drops, especially with injury. I mean, you've lost mastery at that point. A mastery drive is low, autotelicity drive is low. Why would you want to train when it makes you hurt? And so it really kind of leaves you wondering if, well, gosh, one of the things that I found myself worth in was my ability to be disciplined and go to the gym and eat right and have, you know, this great physique. When the proof of that starts waning because the drive for those two motivation pillars is low, it's really easy to kind of come a little bit undone. And so one of the things that I work on with a lot of my guys is like, I don't know if they see that I kind of manage things this way, but you know, it's finding it's sneaky ways of finding like the one thing they need to do to catalyze everything else, all those other pillars of motivation, that drive increasing. And I think for a lot of us, fitness and training is our shell. And when that shell is, I don't want to say damaged, but cracked, it does change how we show up elsewhere. And then we start to lose our self-worth even more. Gosh, I'm not showing up for my company the way I need to. I'm not showing up for my small group that I need to. Man, I snapped at my kids. So finding a way to kind of let training be the linchpin that starts to rebuild their belief system is huge.
Wow, no, I think that's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that so openly. And I can totally see how just by people being able to relate with you when I know you have your little office hours corner, which I think is probably sort of the place where you speak very openly to your guys. And I think that's so great because they actually feel like you understand what they're probably or possibly go through, as opposed to a therapist, a licensed therapist, who's just like, oh, okay, so tell me about your day. And I'm not saying that that's worthless, absolutely not. There's a lot of value to that. But if you have achieved a lot in your sport and in your profession and so on, and then kind of being like, hey, I can't 100% know what you're going through, but let me tell you about my experience and how hard that was for me to pull me out of that, and how it still is every now and then when I fall into a little bit of a hole. And the other thing I think is really good for listeners to hear as well, that sometimes if they see someone on social media or someone that they look up to, and so it's obviously not always just butterflies and unicorns, and there's a lot to that in the sense of self-worth. And even though showing up and teaching and being somewhat of an inspiration is certainly a privilege that you work hard for, but there is stuff that comes with that, and also things to uncover. I love hearing that you have a strong support system also with your husband, with your the two coaches that you mentioned, and just in general your community by the sounds of it. I think too, when we hit a bottom sometimes, and we realize that, hey, I don't want to put on a facade. I just want to tell people what it's really like and show up authentically nonetheless, even if I might lose a few followers, or even if a few people might say like, oh, what Dani used to just share her super strong videos, and now every now and then she just talks about something else that's currently on her mind. Who cares? And we lose those people, and we attract our soulmate tribes, so to speak, the people that really need to hear our message at the time. And even though it's hard, that's the most beautiful thing we can do, I think, showing up authentically in our lives. But I like how you still, it's not like you say to others then, well, then stop going to the gym if currently you're not motivated because you're injured and blah, blah, blah. No, how can we make that something that you still find joy in again? Like maybe it means you need a lift with a lifting buddy again, even if it's not as productive perhaps, or even if it takes twice as long, but you have someone by your side, and isn't that how you started lifting? Or maybe we're gonna drop the powerlifting for a while, and you just do something else that you enjoy right at that point. I think that's really,
Totally.
really important.
I think the mental flexibility component is probably something that I challenge a lot of my people to have. And the reality is that the longer you've been training, you're going to require a different solution in your late 30s, early 40s than you did when you were in your early to mid 20s, right? Body changes, collagen changes, soft tissue changes. You have over time, again, just come back to the rib cage, like the biomechanical components of muscular tension that change our center of mass. Well, that changes how we handle load. So I think having the mental flexibility to recognize how much freedom there is in terms of we have a million possible solutions. And I almost always there's very little I'll guarantee people, but I almost always guarantee that there is a solution. We just need to find the most important constraints to you, whether it's time or maybe you just love deadlifting, even though deadlifting hurts you. Whatever it is, like we'll figure it out. If I know your constraints, man, we can put them together for you in a way that actually empowers you. And I think that's probably something that you really care about with your coaching clients too, whether it's nutrition or the fitness component or even like community support component.
Yeah, definitely. Most of the listeners or our clients are more on the are female, and so I often see, especially for moms or when their body has gone through that kind of change, or then approaching perimenopause, menopause, having some more hormonal disturbances, that can be so hard. So I think the highlighting the message of our body evolves. It's not just our personality that changes over the course of our lives. We can't expect that our personality is the same when we're 50 as it is when we were 20. And likewise, our body's not going to respond the same way to the same exercise stimulus or nutrition things that you did when you were in your 20s that it would when you're in your 50s. It's very, very different. But somehow, sometimes we assume, oh, but I was at that weight then, and I did that diet then, and I did Orange Theory then, and it worked, and why doesn't it work now? And so, yeah, that's so tough.
Totally. It is tough. And I think especially, with that particular population, I do think it's really important to come back to the physiology a little bit, especially knowing that what are the biggest things that women in that age generally struggle with? It's prioritizing themselves and the mental stress associated with that, which very often has a cascade of hormonal, events that happen as a result. You see decreased insulin sensitivity, kind of all of that, which obviously you deal with that every day with your clients.
Yeah, but yeah, tying that together with the breath though that you mentioned earlier,
Right.
I think yeah, that's exactly like sometimes
Oh,
we,
man.
especially now with our devices and so on, or the amount of times that you might be eating while you're on the go and like at the same time texting and like
Eating in front of blue light, like not
yes.
getting sunlight.
Yes.
There's some other training components to that too, where people love like Orange Theory and CycleBar and stuff like that. But a lot of those systems that are super, super, super glycolytic and produce a lot of hydrogen, that's gonna tank insulin sensitivity too. So you can see some of the other physiological implications with just our training style.
Definitely. And yeah, I just love how you're approaching your clients with individuality, with meeting them where they're at, trying to really give them hope as well, because I think that is sometimes something that people have almost given up on if they've tried something for 20 years. So really going back to the point of like, hey, you're just one pivot point away from actually changing your trajectory. So anyone listening, I really encourage you to go and check out Danny's content, because there's not just mindset wise a lot of great things on there, but really also when it comes to biomechanics and physiology. I love some of the banded exercises that you're demonstrating, or someone has like elbow pain or certain knee things or something with their lower back. I've really, really found it super, super helpful. And yeah, also going and checking out your office hours, because I can really imagine it's very helpful. So thank you so, so much for your time, Danny. It's been a true pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Danny. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.